I'm Jonquilin Hill, and from WAMU and PRX, this is Through the Cracks, a podcast about the gaps in our society and the people who fall through them.
R-E-L-I-S-H-A.
The last thing I remember was Felicia telling me she's coming back. She's going to her aunt's house. She never came back.
This season on Through the Cracks, we're investigating the disappearance of Relisha Rudd. Relisha disappeared when she was 8 years old while her family was living in a homeless shelter in Southeast D.C. It took 18 days for anyone to realize she was missing. We're looking at the world Relisha grew up in, her school, her family, her housing.
My sister, her kids, and her baby father were staying with me in a one-bedroom. It was small, but I didn't want them in a shelter.
Was Relisha's disappearance really, as the city claimed, unpreventable?
I guess I would prefer to focus. I know you asked me, like, what more could she have done? But I kind of want to focus instead on what more could the system do for somebody like Miss Young.
On this episode, the shelter where Relisha lived. After Relisha's family was evicted from their apartment, they had to figure out where to sleep. They crashed on family members' couches for a while, but eventually, they exhausted their options and had no place to go.
It was Shamiga's idea to go to the shelter. I didn't want to go. But she just asked me to go to the shelter because people kept putting us out, and it was snowing, and we had kids, so it's like, okay.
Last summer, I met up with Antonio Wheeler, Relisha's stepfather, in a park near the apartment he now shares with his brother. Since the pandemic, we've met in open spaces to keep us both safe. I wanted to know how they figured out where to go, who to ask. I mean, how do you even get into a shelter? Do you just walk in? It turns out, Antonio did what anyone in a bind would do. He got on his phone.
I was Googling shelters. You know, that was my last option. And I called Virginia Williams.
Thank you for calling the Virginia Williams Family Resource Center.
They sent the shelter hotline van out.
He's talking about the Virginia Williams Family Resource Center. At the time, their office building was the first stop for unhoused families in D.C. It's where they run the intake process. Now, it's more complicated with the coronavirus, but back then, families would go to the facility on Rhode Island Avenue. It's near a giant grocery store and the city's only Home Depot. It was already late when Antonio called the shelter hotline, outside of business hours for Virginia Williams and the city shelters.
It was at night when they came and got us, so we went to Virginia Williams and sat in the empty building until the morning until they put us in a hotel at the Days Inn. So I ain't been at the Days Inn for like almost a year because it took them about to place us in the shelter.
A whole year in a dingy hotel. The city used to depend on a few hotels as shelters. They just phased out hotel use for families at the end of 2020. In any case, back then, families were supposed to stay in hotels temporarily, not for a whole year. I've been to this particular hotel. It's in Northeast D.C. on New York Avenue, six lanes of traffic divided by a median, not walkable by any stretch of the imagination. It has an airport hotel feel, despite the fact that it's nowhere near an airport. There's a restaurant called Panda Gourmet, known for its regional Chinese food attached to the lobby of the Days Inn, but you have to know exactly where to turn or you'll end up on Route 50 headed straight out of town. My introduction to that part of town was back in college. I was going to clubs, music venues, and yes, a strip club steakhouse known for its chicken wings that you probably heard about in a Drake song. It was the destination for 21st birthdays. Needless to say, families with small children were not the first thing that came to mind back when I was partying near the stretch of New York Ave. I had no clue that just a short walk away, unhoused families were being sheltered. This was Relisha and her family's home from the winter of 2012 to the winter of 2013. 4 kids, 2 parents, 1 hotel room. Finally, in 2013, the family moved from the hotel to the D.C. General Family Shelter, about 3 miles away in southeast D.C.
It was good when we first got in the shelter. You know, everybody was nice. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want my kids there.
When the family moved in, D.C. General had been used as a shelter for 13 years. Before that, it was a hospital. D.C. General Hospital. This building had a history. The hospital closed in 2001, and the city didn't have a public hospital for 9 years. Most of the patients it served when it was open were poor and Black. When the hospital closed, it became a hypothermia shelter during the cold winter months. D.C. General, the shelter, was supposed to be temporary. But because of the large numbers of people the city needed to house, it ended up operating all year long. When Relisha and her brothers were staying at D.C. General, they were just 4 of more than 600 children living there.
So, we're walking down this ramp towards D.C. General. This is how I got to it last time. It looks like it might be gated off, but D.C. General is right next to the corrections facility. It's in between the corrections facility and the methadone clinic. We're here to see what D.C. General looks like now that it's closed. It closed at the end of 2018. And there's a lot of construction. There's fences up, cranes moving, buildings being torn down. Looks like a construction zone here in southeast D.C. It's gone. This little girl and, like, this place that was so tied to her memory are gone now.
I wanted to go back in time. I wanted a bigger picture of what it was like for Relisha to live there. So I talked to 3 different people. Someone who moved in after Relisha's disappearance. Someone who worked to make the shelter a better place to live. And of course, Antonio, Relisha's stepdad. First, Lakia Barnett.
You know, why would we have to go here? Look at this place. This is the old hospital. I'm just being transparent. Old hospital. And you guys got a bunch of families in here? Like, no.
Lakia moved into the shelter in 2016 with her husband and 3 children. This was a couple years after Relisha went missing. But Lakia still felt her presence in the shelter. Relisha haunted D.C. General like a ghost.
Also about the little girl, you know, that had disappeared from there, that was right in the shelter. So that threw me off, too. We were hearing so much, and we was hearing that staff knew. All kinds of stories was like, roaming around my head, and I was like, I don't want to be here.
Lakia said D.C. General made them feel dehumanized. Every time they came home, they had to pass through security.
Well, the horror stories for me was the fact that we had to get patted down when we come in the building. And it was almost like jail. You have to put your stuff on the little thing that actually scans and just checks to see if there's anything in your bag. So that process was very devastating to me, because all of these people that may have been coming in all at the same time were, we had to kind of like sit and wait when we first got there. And so to me, it felt like this is what they do in jail. At least this is what I heard they do in jails I've never been. We understand the safety of it, but like that was a little scary. And then sometimes we encounter, it could be rude security guards. You know, everybody's not friendly. Maybe they don't like their job and they just impose it on us. Or vice versa, if you flip it around, you can be hearing about the resident, the people that are in the building flipping out on security guards. So it was a lot of different emotions, I think, at that time.
Once Lakia was past security, she would make her way up to the old hospital room assigned to her family.
Well, we were on the 5th floor, and it literally looked like a hospital room. So the setup was cart beds. So 3, let's say 3 carts on the other side and 2 carts on the other side. Then you have your bathroom. That's it.
The bathroom was a toilet and a sink. Dorm-style showers were down the hall. Sometimes residents would bathe their kids in the bathroom sink rather than taking them to the showers.
Then we would take the kids to, like, playtime. Project Playtime was a big help to a lot of children in that shelter. Those people were a big help. It was an outlet for children to go play with other kids. It was an outlet for them to go do things. They would take them on field trips. They would do all of that stuff. So Project Playtime was actually a lot of people's savior in that shelter.
She's talking about the Homeless Children's Playtime Project. This is a program that offers free childcare in the form of playtime a few hours every week at shelters all over D.C. The tape you heard at the beginning of the show?
R-E-L-I-S-H-A.
This audio of Relisha, it comes from a video that the Playtime Project made for marketing purposes. If you Google Relisha Rudd, most of the photos you see of her, and the photo on her missing poster, came from the Playtime Project. Everyone I talked to said Relisha loved going to playtime, just like Lakia's kids.
She was just really sweet and engaging. She loved to dance. She loved art projects.
This is Jamila Larson. She co-founded the Playtime Project. It's not a city program. It's a nonprofit. When it started, she was the only employee. One white woman with a lot of volunteers.
She really found a home in the playroom and endeared herself to a lot of the other children and volunteers. We still have a lot of her art projects and pictures of her engaging with all of our activities in the playroom. Even though she was very protective of her little brothers, she really enjoyed having that time to be a child herself. And that's one thing we tried to help, especially with those older kids in the family. Like, you are an amazing big sister, but this is your time to be a child. And really let her, be 8 years old in the playroom.
The Playtime Project tried to make the shelter more kid-friendly. A lot of what they did was just temporary, like tape on the floor to map out a game of hopscotch. But sometimes the changes were more substantial.
So we were finally able to renovate the waiting room of the former hospital into this beautiful state-of-the-art preteen and teen center. We had a former Metropolitan Police Department conference room that we had renovated several years earlier into a beautiful baby room, and another space that was kind of like a classroom that we renovated into a preteen room. And then we took over the hallways. We painted murals with the help of Capitol Hill Arts Workshop that the kids helped design. But then we bumped up against the bureaucracy every now and then, where someone came out and said, hey, you're defacing government property. Do you have the permits to do this?
Remember, DC General was a former hospital, an abandoned former hospital.
Go behind any double doors, and it looks like the scene of a horror movie. Boxes of medical records. Really shocking. Office supplies. It really looked like there was a nuclear bomb, and people just left. They left a lot of things in those rooms back there.
So it was a weird environment inside. It needed a lot of sprucing up to make it more kid-friendly. And outside, they needed to do some work, too.
Children need a playground. Any apartment complex of that magnitude would obviously have a playground.
Jamila wanted to build a permanent playground using private funding, but the city balked. There was a park a few blocks away, they said. Couldn't the families just walk there? The streets were lined with trees. Certainly it would be good exercise. Jamila thinks that the mayor's office at the time, the Vincent Gray administration, didn't like the way it would look.
Playground symbolizes permanence and play, and it wasn't anything that they wanted to be associated with DC General at the time. The playground would almost enshrine the fact that there are children here. And we were constantly bumping up against the clear reality that the children in DC General were not valued.
The playground eventually got built, but only after Relisha's disappearance. There's one last story I want to share from Jamila. When DC General turned from a hospital into a shelter, the city did a half-assed job changing the street signs. Some of them still directed you to DC General Hospital, not shelter. If you were in a hurry, it was easy to think it was still a hospital.
Once after playtime, our staff person told me that a man had dropped off his friend thinking that it was still an emergency room, and his friend had a gunshot wound to his leg, and he was sitting in the what used to be the waiting room. And there's blood dripping, and families were really panicking. And so if that gives you a sense of, on the outside, it still looked like a hospital. The city never was all in to say, you know, this is a family shelter. Let's make the best of it. Let's make it safe. Let's make it bright. That really wasn't the case, and that was very clear.
We've reached out to the city for a response, but it's complicated. Who is actually responsible here? Who do we even ask for a response? We'll get into that in just a few minutes. After the break, the family meets Khalil Tatum.
I'm Jenny Gathright. I work at WAMU and DCist, the same people that brought you Through the Cracks. I cover policing, jail and prison conditions, and the court system. I know that since you are checking out Through the Cracks, these are important issues to you, and you think about them critically. You can check out my reporting on these important local issues at DCist.com. I'm Jenny Gathright. I'm a reporter at WAMU, the people that brought you Through the Cracks. I cover policing, jail and prison conditions, and the court system. Since you're here, I know you think about these issues with the same critical lens I do in my work. Listen live at WAMU.org to stay up to date with the latest news, including my reporting.
About 2 years ago, we asked the members of our home station, WAMU, to make an extra donation to support this podcast. And it paid off. We raised more than a third of what we needed to greenlight this show. 2 years later, we're still working to produce this show and even looking ahead to season two. That means that your support can be part of making that possible. Give at wamu.org/support-through-the-cracks. And thank you.
It wasn't for no family.
This is Antonio Wheeler again, Relisha's stepdad. It took some time, but he and his family adjusted to life in the shelter.
But it wasn't no good living conditions. They just serve us molded food. So at that point, you know, we had got coolers and ice set in our rooms. They were saying we couldn't do that, but we like, y'all sending us spoiled milk and molded food. We had to cut hot dogs open to see if it was molded on the inside, you know? Because somebody kid had got sick from eating that food.
When it was time to eat, typically the whole family would go down to the cafeteria together. They'd line up and wait to be served. That's actually how they met Khalil Tatum, the man who was last seen with Relisha.
Everybody asks how he got so close to the family. When I first met Khalil Tatum, he wasn't always a janitor at the shelter. He was the kitchen staff, the cafeteria dude. So he was serving the kids, the families and the kids, the food.
And while a lot of the staff at the shelter could be cold or wanted to bargain for favors, Khalil Tatum seemed generous.
We came into play. We used to come in late from dinner, from us running around at the mall or at the playground. When we ain't want the kids at the shelter, me and a lot of other parents would take our kids to another playground or whatever. So sometimes we'll run late and he'll put our food up for us. And like, we can open our room door in the kitchen, like right there. Like I could stick my head out and get the food. So Alicia, you know, see, she always wanted to help out. She's like, Daddy, I go get the food. I just open the door and watch her get the food. He'll give her the food and shut the door and nothing. No extra, you know, nothing, none of that.
Nothing extra. I think what Antonio means here is that Khalil Tatum didn't come off as creepy. He didn't seem like an older man trying to groom a girl and her family. As far as Antonio could tell, Tatum was just someone trying to help. When we asked for people's first impressions of Khalil Tatum, the answers were largely positive. If anything, his kindness made him stand out among the workers at DC General. DC General had a policy not to hire people with criminal records. There's a conversation to be had about excluding formerly incarcerated people from job opportunities, but this was the policy. And, as it turned out, Khalil Tatum had a criminal record when he was hired to work at DC General. He'd served time for breaking and entering, larceny, and burglary. So, his working there was a policy violation. In effect, he slipped in through the cracks. But it's not surprising when you look at how things were run at the time. I went online and took a look at the shelter monitoring records for the years that Relisha lived there. Out of the randomly pulled employee files, none had FBI or Metropolitan Police Department background checks, which surprised me because I had to get a background check for volunteering as the leader of a Girl Scout troop in DC. People who work around kids typically have to get vetted. Jamila Larson, the co-founder of the Playtime Project that you heard a few minutes ago, one time she asked a shelter resident about how staff interacted with her. Did she remember anything inappropriate taking place?
She said, no, not really. And I further explored. I said, so, you know, staff didn't, like, hit on people or anything like that. And she's like, oh, yeah, that happens all the time, but I didn't know they weren't supposed to do that. Oh, wow. So we heard a lot of stories like that, especially of security guards and other folks who just didn't get a lot of training or supervision or support, didn't have high expectations for what those safety roles were supposed to be.
So how do you figure out who's responsible for the conditions at DC General? Well, that's a tricky question. It's tricky because the responsibility has shifted over the years. In 1993, the federal government said to DC, you're doing a lousy job running your shelters. You can't run them anymore. You need to have a nonprofit do this. So this is when an organization called the Community Partnership came into the picture. Their job was to find contractors to run the day-to-day operations for homelessness services. Okay, bear with me here. This is kind of a bureaucratic Gordian knot. The contractor for DC General, yet another nonprofit hired by the Community Partnership, came under fire in 2010 after an explosive report from the Washington City paper. In the report, several residents described incidents where staff members solicited sex from residents for things like extra blankets and juice for their kids. After that, no other contractor wanted to touch DC General. So the Community Partnership ended up running it themselves. This is not something the Community Partnership normally does. We reached out to them for comment, and they declined to speak with us. So if, when something goes wrong, who's responsible? Well, staff at the shelter would and did get blamed for their hiring choices. The Community Partnership is partially responsible, too, because they didn't enforce their own policies for hiring and fraternization. So they came under fire when Relisha went missing. But also the DC government for not making conditions at the shelter better. And the federal government, because their intervention in 1993 is what got us here. In the end, though, you can't hold any one of these groups accountable. That's because in a system this unwieldy, no one is fully responsible for the people who lose their housing.
Oh, Mom, he's cool. That's Khalil Tatum. That's her godfather. No. Well, Khalil is her godfather, Mom, but he cool. He just takes her to play with the granddaughter.
On one of my visits with Relisha's grandmother, Melissa, I asked her about Khalil Tatum. She told me Relisha never gave her any reason to worry about him.
Whenever she went, she came and told everything they did, who she was with, who she did it with, everything. She never had nothing negative to say about him, his wife, or nobody else.
Next time on Through the Cracks, who is Khalil Tatum?
No, Carl was his name. Khalil was the name that he changed to when he went to prison.
Everybody knows him. You know, he bought my daughter a fish tank, but I stopped it there. Mm-mm, no more gifts.
A lot of the teens had known him, and some of them even referred to him affectionately as their godfather as well, and had a really hard time believing that he would do something like that. The teens were feeling really conflicted because, again, like, they had a hard time wrapping their head around how could this man that we trusted and esteemed, who was nice to us, do something like that.
Through the Cracks is a production of WAMU and PRX. This podcast was made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and also by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Patrick Fort is our producer, Ruth Tam is our digital editor, and Ponce Rutsch is our senior producer. Our editor is Curtis Fox. Mike Kidd mixed this episode. Osei Hill designed our logo. Mona Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. You can find out more about the show at wamu.org/throughthecracks. You can also sign up for email updates. That way, you'll be the first to know when we drop a new episode or bonus content. Our podcast would not be possible without the generosity of listeners like you. To support the investigative reporting that powers Through the Cracks, give at wamu.org/supportthroughthecracks. I'm Jonathan Hill. We'll be back next Thursday with another episode. Thanks for listening.